Hello and welcome to the Cardiff Podcast. My name is Alistair Love. Joining me on episode 17 is Ian Thomas, Chief Executive of Trevallis Housing Association. Now, Ian is a passionate advocate for social housing and the wider regenerative projects Trevallis and other organisations do in Valleys communities. We talk about the key role housing associations play at a time when there is major pressure on the very basic requirement of finding somewhere decent to live. We also explore Ian's long and varied career path, as well as what a 15-year-old Valleys boy actually got up to in Cardiff in the 1970s. We even get some poetry, so please rate and review the podcast. But for now, sit back and enjoy Ian Thomas. He sounds very much like this. I suppose, first of all, then, tell us a bit about Trevallis, because not a lot of listeners will maybe be familiar with their work.
Okay, well, Trevallis is a very large housing association based in Pontypridd. We have over 10,000 homes across mainly around the Cannon Taff, although we do have a couple of hundred down in sunny Cardiff Bay. Formerly, the housing stock was owned by the council, so back in 2007, it was a big stock transfer. The housing association was set up originally as RCT Homes, and we became Trevallis 2 years ago.
What does Trevallis actually mean?
Trevallis doesn't really mean anything. It's one of those kind of, I guess, pseudo-Latin names. I guess it means three valleys. So Rhondda, Cannon, Taff, you know, when I was growing up.
That makes sense.
Yeah, Rhondda Valley, Cannon Valley, and then Taff Ely.
Yeah. Do you pay someone a lot of money to come up with a name?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Trevallis is a nice catch-all, I think.
It is. Actually, now you've explained it, it's bloody obvious, isn't it? That works quite well. So obviously, housing is a massive issue in Wales and the UK. Yeah. What are your reflections of where we're at the moment?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, housing is a basic human right as far as I think we should all be concerned. You know, I came through Queen Street earlier on today and, you know, the tents are back up. People need places to live. Quite frankly, there's a big shortage. There's a shortage of affordable housing more than anything, which includes everything from social housing for rent, such as we do, through to kind of low-cost home ownership, right through. So reflections are we're probably not doing enough, and that's across the UK. Aspirationally, I think the Welsh Government has the right aspirations in terms of 20,000 new homes over the next 5 years, but we have to make sure it's affordable. Affordability is the big key.
So basically, do you think there is a stigma around social housing?
I think there has been. I think social housing was very much seen often by a lot of people, quite wrongly, as somehow second rate perhaps to home ownership. But I think the tide's turned, certainly in terms of the ability for people to own houses these days. Social housing becomes a very affordable option. I think moving forward, it could even become sexy again, social housing, because it certainly gives people the ability to live in somewhere really decent, tidy, with good landlords, such as social landlords tend to be. Jobs get done when they need doing, you know. I've lived in social housing 4 times myself, twice here in Cardiff, council flat in Llanedin, housing association property in Adamsdown, and I also lived in East London, also in Surrey, in social housing. So personally, you know, I've always had good experiences of social housing, but sometimes people do react to you slightly differently when you tell them you're a social tenant.
It's an odd thing, and it shouldn't be the case. It's almost a British disease in a sense, isn't it? Because in Europe, you know, rental is just sort of standard. You know, there's not such a culture of needing to own your own place or have higher rents. You know, there's a more defined social housing aspect, isn't there?
Well, I think if you look at areas of Northern Europe, particularly in places like France, certainly Spain, Italy as well, there is a reasonable culture of people renting accommodation, albeit across social and private rented sectors. I think the strive that perhaps John Major's government had, you know, back in the 90s, of this idea of a land owning democracy or a property owning democracy, perhaps was somewhat of a false aspiration, really, because it's just not for everyone.
No.
You know, people rent and people enjoy renting, and renting does give you flexibility.
Yeah. But it did become the given that we have to own our, you know, that. When you drill down into it, you think, why?
It's not a given, was it?
I mean, that's what I mean, but it was, wasn't it? It was a sort of be all and end all, and council houses were sold and all that.
Well, I mean, you know, that's an interesting political point, isn't it, about council houses being sold? And, you know, we've got to look at, you know, the history of this, and I'm afraid to bring politics into it, but it all kind of went a bit wrong when Thatcher was around. Mind you, a lot of things went wrong when Thatcher was around. You know, the kind of the housing legislation that was coming through in the 1980s meant, you know, councillors were stopped from building further stock because she had some balmy idea that the profits from council housing coming through the, you know, the housing revenue accounts at the time was being used to fund what she called loony left projects.
Yeah.
Well, actually, what she ended up doing was she stopped the investment the councillors were able to put into housing, and at the same time, she started selling it off. Well, it's not surprising we got a housing crisis, is it? Yeah. You know, I've got to say though, you know, here in Wales, we've stopped the right to buy, and over the border in England, you know, these things still exist.
Yeah.
So I think we've made some right moves in Wales now, and hopefully we'll start to see the supply of the stock go up again.
Yeah. And being very thorough in my search, I had a look on your website. You were very, and you've said to yourself to me, you're in the forefront of fighting poverty. What marks you out then as a housing association in tackling those kind of issues? And what poverty do you see? What are the on the front line? What is the stuff that you see?
So, well, let me just answer that first of all with a couple of examples. At the end of summer 2018, I was in Cwmaman for the Cwmaman Festival, a music festival. And I was talking to a couple of our tenants, living in a flat in, you know, Cwmaman's near Aberdeen. It's where the Stereophonics are from, so everybody knows where Cwmaman is, you know. And they were both in 0 hours paid jobs. They worked in the care sector. And I was talking to both of them, and the guy said to me, "We are lucky because we don't rely on food banks." Okay? Now, these are two people who work various hours. The new Universal Credit was coming in November 2018. Yeah. And they were saying, when Universal Credit comes in, we won't have the certainty of income if our hours drop. Now, there are people in employment who are poor, you know, people who want to work and indeed do work. So I think, you know, a lot of our customers, if you like, are kind of, you know, they that's the kind of lives they lead. The opportunities for employment in the valleys isn't as great as perhaps it could be. But we see other poverty as well. We see poverty and deprivation, which stretches right back, and I'm afraid to bring Thatcher back into it, but I'm going to, and right back to the days of the coal mines, you know, the mines shut in. I'm from Penrhyn in the Cannon Valley. I'm a proud Khyber boy. Mm-hmm. I'm also known as the gobby shite from the Khyber, which
can't
does...
not believe that.
You know, well, you know. So, you know, all of my family were in the mining industry.
Yeah.
And... you know, we've never really recovered. No. We haven't had the inward investment. There hasn't been the companies attracted to the valleys for perhaps transport link reasons that they could have been. And it's just left this legacy of deprivation and poverty.
You could argue, and I would argue, there's been a romanticism of a romanticising of that era. What? Because it's not great.
There was nothing romantic about the mines.
No, well, that's what I'm saying. But it is romanticised in a sense. But it is rightly remembered. But it did give structure and people jobs and all that sort of stuff. But I suppose the key point is, when it went away, nothing was brought in to replace it. Nothing meaningful, or, you know, they put some shopping malls up or whatever. And
to go back to the earlier point you made about Trevallis and where we sit, what we've seen in the valleys has been consecutive programmes that have come in. Tried to regenerate, if you like, but then they've gone. So, you know, there's not a continuity. You know, I say it to our staff and our customers and our volunteers all the time. We are in Rhondda Cynon Taf to stay, right? Mm. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So for me, Trevallis is one of the anchors, along with partners such as the local authority up there, you know, and other third sector organisations too, that can actually make a difference in people's lives. You know, I grew up in poverty myself. It was a different kind of poverty. My dad was a miner who had an accident in a pit. He had chronic bronchitis, emphysema, mining diseases which killed him. And we were caught in a poverty trap at the time because he had a small miner's pension which barred us from the benefit system, you know. So, you know, and that was difficult for me. My older siblings had all left home. So I was living effectively with a mother who was herself slightly disabled, and a father who spent 23 hours in bed the day because he was depressed because of his emphysema.
Yeah.
So that kind of poverty, you know, it stays with you. But if I was to be honest, I think poverty in the valleys is worse now. What we got, at least, was really good support from the local community in Penrhyn-Cyber. Yeah. And my mother was very, very well thought of in the village, which kind of helped, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, to go back to Trevalis again then, what did Trevalis do to attack these issues, to deal with them? Because you obviously see, as you say, you see the full gamut with your tenants. What do you actually do?
Well, you know, bricks and mortar are always going to be our key provision. You know, that's what we set up to do. We're a registered social landlord. That's how we regulated, which is right and proper. But beyond that, we got a lot of community initiatives which we do. A lot of work we do with business in the community. We do a lot of what we call giving game days. So we will go into communities, you know, often where our housing is situated, and we will go and regenerate, you know, big parts of communities such as the community centres. Only today we've made a decision to go up into Penrhys and do some work up there with the schools. We do a lot of work with the schools, lots work with schools like Ferndale School in Rhondda. So it's really about that wider community engagement. And so it's beyond bricks and mortar really. And aspirationally, I think with partners we will do a lot more. And we'll do a lot more around regeneration as well.
So I saw that you recently, there was a library in Rhydfelen you were involved with as well.
Indeed.
How important are projects like that? Because those are, they were sort of, I hate to use the word easy, but they were almost easy hits, weren't they, for councils who were struggling?
Well, actually, the Rhydfelen library close in Rhydfelen is an interesting case in point, because we had older people's accommodation there, which had stopped really being fit for purpose. So we needed to replenish that accommodation. And we did a deal with the local authority where we took a piece of land over. We built the older people's flats around that area, and we provided the library. So that's a good example of community regeneration. It's one we're very proud of.
Yeah, and that's actually tangible, isn't it? And how do the community respond?
Oh, the community's really, you know, really happy about that.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's gratifying as well to be able to go up there and talk to our customers, you know, to our tenants who use that library facility. They're older anyway. It gives them internet access. It gives them the ability to borrow books. Perhaps they're digitally excluded in other ways. You know, they might not be the generation, for example, to download on a Kindle. You know,
it gives them
tangible buildings, and it gives them tangible things to go and borrow, like books.
Yeah.
It's great.
Which is great. So your role then, obviously you're a chief executive. What's your sort of style then? Because I've met a few in my time. Some have been very remote and have an And I know chief execs do sort of they have an overseeing role, but can be very aloof as a result.
Yeah.
What's your personal style?
Well, I mean, I say it. Leadership's a contact sport. I don't see leadership as any different to playing rugby, really. It's a contact sport. I can't be remote. It's not in my natural style anyway. I would hope that people would think that my style is about contact, it's about openness, it's about transparency, it's about being able to have a proper, you know, a proper conversation. And, you know, people certainly in the office know the door's open, and they do come through that open door. So, and I like that, it's good. Community wise, I do spend a lot of time out on our estates with our customers. Penrhys last week, Aberdeen the week before. I'm due to go up to Penwine in a couple of weeks' time. And I actually really enjoy being out with the communities. Trevalis, it's got to be said, we're one of the largest, we are the largest community mutual in Wales, you know, which makes us owned by our customers.
Yeah.
So for me not to spend time with our customers would be a travesty from what I...
Well, it would, wouldn't it?
I see.
And also, you said to me the other day that many of your sort of people you employ live in Trevalis stock as well, yeah?
We do.
Are
have
your tenants, yeah?
We do.
Not
we have
many, but you have some. Yeah.
Trevalis is an interesting place. It's certainly the best place I've ever worked, and I'm sorry for my former employers who might be hearing that. But I mean, the people in Trevalis, you know, the staff in Trevalis are just phenomenal.
Yeah.
They're just committed, they're dedicated, and they're rooted in the communities. You know, we do have a lot of our staff who are tenants, and if they're not tenants of us as a housing association, they're often tenants of other associations in the area as well.
Yeah.
So they are very rooted, and you know, the direction of travel, that makes the direction of travel quite easy, because people want to achieve for the communities. There's not a, you know, we don't have to undergo a campaign in Trevalis. People know what they want to do.
Yeah.
So that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And of course, people who are not our tenants, the vast majority of our staff live in Rondacunnintaff anyway, or from Rondacunnintaff.
So cheek by jowl with the community in which they work. Yeah?
Very much cheek by jowl, and also as well, very rooted in the kind of the local businesses as well.
Yeah.
So people do, you know, make good use of those of local businesses. You go to Pontypridd even now on a Wednesday and it's market day, and you still see people from the valleys coming down as they did when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know.
Strikes me the political climate at the moment is quite easy to begin despairing. Do you, in your role, is it a sense of you can control the controllables, that you know in your patch, in your existence, you're actually doing something good for the community? Does that kind of blot out the horrendous feeling there is around generally at
the doomsday scenario?
Well, it is bad though, isn't it? There's a general...
It's not good, is it? I don't think at this point of 2019, and just for the good listeners, it is kind of mid-February. It is a bit grim at the moment. Do I think we can blot that out? Not really, because, you know, whether we like it or not, the wider political context is having a detrimental effect on all of us. It can be psychologically, it can be kind of physically. You know, we are seeing some jobs dry up in some areas even now. You know, we got further threats ahead. Only in the last couple of days, we've seen an announcement in Swindon about Toyota shutting.
Honda, sorry, Toyota.
Strike that.
But
I mean, Honda, then there's kind of businesses linked in other parts of the valleys to places like Merthyr.
Yeah.
So I think what we've got to realise is everything's connected, and one shudder elsewhere in the economy can have a bigger shudder further on down the line.
So in a sense, then you've almost, it's not controlling the controllables, you've almost got an extra sense of responsibility in a way.
I don't think anybody can control it at the moment. Yeah. It feels very uncontrollable. I think in terms of the local political situation, in terms of the aspirations in Rondacunnintaff, the wash up, I guess, from the city deal in Cardiff, we have expectations around that.
Yeah.
There's going to be some form of spread of that benefit.
Mm.
But of course, what we don't know yet is what happens after the 29th of March and whether or not there's going to be any blocks put in away because of whatever happens on the 29th of March, you know.
Because frankly, we just don't know at the moment.
We just don't know.
If you're listening to the future, well, God only knows what's happened. But yeah, it is a bit of a frightening one now. So tell us a bit about how, you know, obviously a chief exec, that's pretty much getting to the top. So what was your route? I almost said journey. I hate that bloody phrase. What's been your route to that position? And what... take your time as well. You could go into as much detail as you want about it.
I mean, you know, I think... You know, I didn't. I don't think you wake up when you wake up in your conscious life and you think, "Oh, I want to be a chief exec when I grow up."
Yeah.
I think, you know, aspirationally, when I was growing up, I wanted to be a rock star, and I still hold that aspiration.
Still somewhere in the back of my head.
And you know, coupled with being a poet living on the left bank of the Seine in Paris, I had high aspirations for a boy from Penrhyn. But I mean, I started my career in education, really, youth and community work. In fact, my move back to Wales in the early 90s to the council flat in Llanedin, I was the youth and community worker, or the community education officer in Splott, you know?
Yeah.
So that was my kind of route into employment, if you like.
Yeah.
I was teaching part-time as well. I've done stints in higher education at universities in Cardiff. I did 26 years part-time with the Open University. You know, one of the longest serving members of staff, actually 28 years.
What were you doing in the Cardiff University? Lecturing?
The Open University. I started as what was then a tutor counsellor back in 1991 in social sciences. And it's only in 2018 to early 2019 that I stopped being an associate. I've been trying to get out for a while, mind.
Yeah.
They kept saying, "Oh, hang on. Because they just needed some kind of extra hands, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I did stints in the third sector and in housing. I worked for other housing associations up until 2005, mainly in the domain of supported housing, specialist housing for vulnerable people with needs such as mental health issues, learning disabilities, you know, the full gambit, really.
Yeah.
And then in 2005, I became the first director of the Alzheimer's Society in Wales. I was there for 6 years, 4 as the Welsh director, 2 as the executive director of services across the UK. Mm. Did 2 years for the disability charity Scope, And I became a chief executive originally in December 2013, where I became the chief executive of Age Cymru, the National Older People's Charity in Wales. I guess that was an interesting moment in time because I got to be a chief executive and I picked the phone up to one of my old bosses. In fact, he'd been a chief executive in United Welsh. And I said, "Tony, I've become a chief exec accidentally. Can you tell me what to do?" So I don't think you really plan for these
That's
things.
That's a hell of a question.
It's, you know,
what did he say? He put the phone down.
He kind of laughed, you know, and I said, "Look, let me buy you lunch and you can tell me what to do." And, you know, and I respected the guy so much because I'd worked with him for like 5 years.
Yeah.
And what we did, he kindly offered up a lot of his time and he mentored me, you know, into that role. And he everything he told me came true as well, which was quite strange. He said, "When you first meet your senior team, they won't say a word, you know, they'll sit around the table and expect you to speak first."
Yeah.
And I did that, and that's exactly what they did, you know. There was a number of other things. But I mean, you don't set out to be a chief exec. I see myself as being incredibly fortunate and lucky, and to be the chief exec of Trevallis is an absolute privilege.
I noticed you flagged a quote up on LinkedIn from Richard Branson of all people, who said when a great opportunity comes to you, learn how to do it after, say yes, and learn how to do it afterwards. So is that basically what you did?
That's basically what I did. And I think that moment in time came from when I was at the Alzheimer's Society. I'd been the Welsh director for 4 years. I was very, very happy.
Yeah.
That
must have been really interesting work.
It was great, you know, and, you know, setting the thing up in Wales, there was a lot of services already in existence. They were very spread across a number of, you know, number of parts of Wales.
Yeah.
But for the first time in 2005, stepping into that role and bringing together all the services, starting and working with the campaigns, you know, pushing dementia up in the public eye, they were all really, really important things. And from a cause point of view for me at that time, my mum had dementia.
Yeah.
You know, she died when she was 78. It was vascular dementia.
Yeah.
But my sister had dementia at 51. So my elder sister also had vascular dementia at 51, partly because of other health issues that she'd had. Sadly died when she was 59, you know. So I had a cause with dementia.
Yeah.
Very much.
So you wouldn't be surprised then how it's massively high profile now, isn't it? Alzheimer's and dementia in general.
Well, if I was to see you in 2005, you know, when the regional structure was put in place at the Alzheimer's Society, and this is big credit to that charity at the time, we sat down, it was a team of regional directors and a team of directors based down in London, and we basically sat around for days. And the plan was, how do we have a plan?
Yeah.
You know, how do we put dementia in the public eye? How do we raise it to the same status as some of the other causes? And cancer is a very good example of that.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things I learned at the time was it was the media strategy, because the media strategy was basically shock and awe, you know.
Right.
And we all got trained in BBC methods, radio and TV in my case. And it was just like any opportunity to go on any form of media to talk about dementia, you're on.
Yeah.
So, you know, the number of mornings I spent in the BBC studios in Cardiff at 6 a.m, you know, started to kind of, you know, get quite silly at one point.
Yeah.
But a great example of how you can always turn a story around was, I don't know if you remember on Coronation Street, you know, Mike Baldwin got dementia at one point, you know, one of the characters.
I don't remember that.
And he died. He died in very, very quick succession, having got the condition. And that's not how it works, to be honest with you. But our media manager rang me up and she said, "Right, get up the BBC, 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, you're going on to talk about Mike Baldwin." And he did, and she gave me the line. And of course, I got interrogated on the radio, you know, "That doesn't really happen like this, does it, Ian?" You know, and I go, "But boy, you got to remember, it's on every street."
Yeah.
So straight away, you know, the hook wasn't about the unreality of the condition developing in the soap opera. It was about, it's on every street.
Yeah.
It's on your street. It's on every street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's a really good example of how a charity took a cause and pushed it in order to raise up the profile.
Yeah.
And for the better.
And it really worked.
It worked.
And actually now, and as you say, it's on every street. Like my mother died of it last summer. Everyone you sort of speak to will say, "Oh yeah, I know so-and-so.
Absolutely.
My family." You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's
so the Alzheimer's Society offered me really good opportunities. Four years in the Welsh role, as I said, I was very, very happy. And then what happened is there'd been a a switch at senior management down in London, and my then boss, Ruth Sutherland, who's now the chief executive of the Samaritans UK, rang me up and she said, when are you coming for your interview? And I said, well, I haven't applied for a job. And she says, well, I'm accidentally the chief executive now. You know, yeah. There's a theme there.
Yeah.
I need you to come and do my job for a while, you know. So it was a kind of shot in the dark, really.
Yeah.
It exposed me to much wider UK styles of working. Also over in places like Northern Ireland, yeah. Where, you know, obviously the Good Friday Agreement, things are done slightly differently, yeah. There. But it was a great opportunity. I took it, and yeah, it's great. Yeah,
absolutely. What? So you know, it's a hugely important role in an organisation. What do you? Because you've got your own style. You're very hands on. Your door's always open. What do you think are the key attributes you need to do that job?
A chief executive.
Yeah.
I think first of all, you've got to be open to the organisation and what the values of the organisation are. Sometimes you go into an organisation and I've done it with Trevalis, it's a natural fit because of the community purpose of the organisation, yeah. Because of the way things are just generally geared, because of how fantastic the people are. But I think you've got to be open to the values. I think you've got to have an open mind as well, because you'll often come across business practices which might be unfamiliar to you. You should never, ever be afraid to ask. But the key thing for me, or one of the most key things for me, is you've got to respect your staff, because yeah. At the end of the day, they're the experts.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm going to misquote Steve Jobs now. It's something like, and I believe in this. Steve Jobs said something along the lines of, you know, you don't employ intelligent, brilliant people and tell them what to do. You employ them and let them tell you what to do.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we do at Trevalis. You know, I don't know where all. I don't pretend to, and yeah. No chief exec should pretend to.
No. Yeah. And what do you actually? What's the best thing about the role then for you? You've been in it a while now, haven't you? So what? When you come home in the night, what you think? Oh, that was great today. What is it that really gets you up in the morning?
Common purpose.
Yeah.
And I'm one of these really annoying people who really likes Monday mornings. You know, I'm probably more of a Monday morning guy than I am a Friday afternoon guy, because I think I'm a bit full on sometimes. But I think what it is for me is that common purpose, that people know what they're about, you know, and it's the compassion. And I'll give you an example of this, you know, and this is just the way people function at Trevalis, and I'm so proud of them. I was in our downstairs space last summer. And there was an older guy there, and he was eating a bag of chips. And what had happened was that he'd collapsed on the pavement outside, and one of the staff had gone out, brought him in, obviously called for some medical advice, and then went and bought him a bag of chips because she realised he was starving.
Right.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
You know, that speaks bucket loads about the organisation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think any organisation that's got staff that do that is an organisation that needs to exist.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely. So going back to Trevalis and your goals there, then where do you see that housing association going? You know, it sounds like you're doing amazing work. What, you know, how do you keep that moving?
Yeah, well, we've just gone through a big exercise. It's not an exercise. We've just gone through a big setting up of our strategy and our vision moving forward.
Mm.
It is really about making sure we do provide and we regenerate our communities. Because,
yeah.
we've got some of the oldest housing stock in Europe.
Yeah.
And some of it, you know, we've had to put a lot of work into maintain it, its current standard. And that's going to be challenging going forward to us. We're not going to be able to retrofit loads of carbon neutral technology, for example, even though we'd love to.
Yeah. Just not possible.
Just not possible. No. Physically not possible. Yeah. But you know, there will be alternatives to doing that. I'm sure. So regenerating our communities, making sure we get that partnership approach going, so that we can regenerate the wider community beyond, you know, where our estates are.
Where are you at with the sort of partnership work? How much do you do of that?
Quite a lot, actually.
It's quite a buzzword in that sort of sector, isn't it? So what does that actually look like?
So a good example would be, you know, we do work with a number of third sector organisations in provision around services for older people. The RNIB is a good example,
yeah.
Royal National Institute of the Blind, doing a lot of work with them, particularly in our sheltered complexes for older people. So we're up to high standards in them now, which is just really good to see, really pleasing. We work, as I said earlier, with business in the community to look at community regeneration projects as well. We're going to do a lot more of that. We work with learning disabilities organisations. We're currently in the process of putting together quite a big new or regenerated learning disability scheme for people in Rhondda Cynon and Taf. And obviously the local authority as well. A lot of partnership work in there in terms of how we even allocate into our stock, because it was it's a condition of stock transfer that, you know, that they that we use their housing lists.
Right.
But I mean, so there's a wide range of stuff going on at the moment, and some of it's actually quite big pieces of work.
Yeah.
I think where I'd like to see a bit more is perhaps health, definitely. I think we've got a golden opportunity to work much more closely with the health board, with Cwm Taf.
Yeah.
Perhaps even around provision to stop kind of the, you know, the delayed transfer of care, particularly over the winter months. Mm-hmm. Perhaps being able to provide things like temporary accommodation for people who don't need to be on hospital wards. You know, there's all kinds of initiatives I think we want to explore.
Yeah, sure. What are, and this is probably an obvious question, what are the pressures like on the housing lists in Ponty and RCT?
Well, I think, you know, any community which has come from the place that the communities in Rhondda Cynon and Taf have in particular, with the deprivation, with the levels of, you know, impoverishment in certain cases, reliance on food banks is another big issue.
Yeah.
But even you've got to dig back into the past and you see people, older people, with a lot more longer term conditions because of the industrial past. You know, I mentioned my dad, you know, he had chronic bronchitis, emphysema. There's still a lot of people who would have had industrial or have industrial illnesses going back to the times of the pit still being open, older now. But also some of the factory conditions and some of the issues around the asbestos and the kind of glue as well, you know.
Yeah.
Some of those factories. So we do have quite a kind of fragile population in terms of the health, which is bound to put pressures on health authorities and the health board.
So you feel that could be a bit more joined up, if anything? Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about joined up working with health and social care forever, from what I can see. Have we ever achieved it? I think we've made some attempts to achieve it, but sometimes people have got to be a bit more receptive to different ideas.
So as an organisation, and you're never standing still, are you? You just can't, you know.
Can't stand still. I think, you know, I have this saying, you know, I talk about leadership being a contact sport, you know, but, you know, standing still is not an option either.
No.
And I think there has to be some kind of energy in a business, and a social housing world is quite energetic generally. It's certainly... for those people who might be listening to this who are looking for careers, is certainly a sector I would encourage people to seriously look at, because I think quite often it floats under the radar, you know.
Yeah, I think it does. I'm convinced a lot of people wouldn't even know about some of the opportunities that would exist in that sector, you know.
I think you're right. I think I think the sector has tried to take a grip of that. I think it's trying to make sure that it's out there a bit more in terms of the job fairs and stuff. But still, I think we've got a lot more. We've got a lot further to go. Yeah.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. In a way, that's good for yourselves, isn't it? Because you think your work's never done, in a way, isn't it?
I don't think our work's ever going to be done, quite frankly. And you know, I think the geographical challenges that come working in valleys communities is another factor for us specifically. But you know, the whole idea of regeneration coming up for the Cardiff City deal and the idea of the metro. Is an exciting prospect for us. So we are starting to see some, you know, some big moves in Pontypridd, and Porth now is being, you know, is the next kind of area that we will hopefully see some regeneration.
Yeah, well, you've got to hope so. And you're right, the metro project, that could be immense, couldn't it?
Well, I think it has to be.
If it ever happens.
One thing perhaps, you know, it's emerged over the last kind of few days, really. You know, we're talking about up in the old Tower Colliery at the top end of the Cynon Valley, you know, around the Rickoss area, you know, one of these zip wire projects. And people are already starting to ask questions about whether the train line is going to be able to go from Aberdeen up to that area.
Yeah.
You know, those lines do exist because they're the old coal, you know, the old coal lines got there. But I think we have to be a bit smart about making sure that we don't put resources in places where people can't get to them. And I would hope that perhaps that regeneration of the train line will go further up the valleys quicker than we are currently aspiring for it to be so.
Yeah, it's very much an Arriva train style timetable at the moment, it seems to me. So, but yeah, I'm sure they'll get there. But that's enough about work, I think, at the moment. What's Cardiff life like then? It's a bloody busy job, isn't it, what you've got? So how on earth do you relax?
I think, first of all, I think, you know, I'm a Valleys boy. And my attraction to Cardiff was basically in my youth. You know, I'm a middle-aged guy now with a relatively young child and a wife also in employment. Yeah. So I think opportunities for enjoying ourselves kind of, don't come as frequently as they might have in the past.
That's beautifully put.
Well, I'm trying to be subtle for the microphone. Subtlety's not really my key, my key attribute. Cardiff life. I mean, Cardiff's a great city. I think there's some people who see Cardiff now and they say, oh, you know, it's evolved as a great city. It's a 24-hour city. I got news for you. It was a 24-hour city when I was a kid. And I should know because I was down here when I shouldn't have been in Cardiff. Tripping the Light Fantastic at 15. Going to punk rock gigs in the Top Rank on Queen Street, for those people old enough to remember that.
I remember the Top Rank. Who did you see there?
I saw a lot of bands there. So I've seen Susie and the Banshees there, supported by Spiz Oil and Nico from Velvet Underground, of all people. Many others. I mean, just before I moved away from home for the first time, I saw the Undertones there.
Yeah.
They were a brilliant band. Yeah, yeah. And of course, I was part of that generation who was around during the ska revival. So, seeing the Specials down here was quite an interesting night.
Yes. Yeah,
especially as it was before one of my A-levels.
Did that help or hinder you? I don't know.
Well, I passed, so I didn't do me any harm. But I think, you know, I got one of those attractions to Cardiff. I like living in a city. I don't think my wife will let me move back up the valleys, partly because of my daughter's in school and she's 10.
Yeah.
But I think, aspirationally, I keep saying to her, let's move to Pontypridd, you know. And your response to that is, well, I won't tell you what your response to that is, but it goes along the lines of, it's not going to happen because I'll never see you.
Yeah.
Because basically you'll spend all day in work and all night down a rugby club.
Yeah.
And she might have a point.
So she's got you trapped in Radda then.
She has, you know.
Tantalisingly close, isn't it?
Tantalisingly close. And she has pointed out, you know, we've lived in other parts of Cardiff. We lived in Kent, and everybody lives in Kent at some point, I think. And we lived in Llandaff North as well, you know. Mm-hmm. So we moved up to Radda some 12 years ago now. And she says, you can just about see RCT from you, can't you? And she's right, I can see.
You get on the roof.
You can see it from our bedroom. Well, you can see Castle Coch and you can just about see Caerphilly Mountain as well. So it's not quite RCT. But,
so does she catch you staring out the window?
Lovingly looking up the valley, you know. Cardiff is a great city.
That's the joy of it, in a sense. It's a great city, and you've got all that on your doorstep, haven't you? You've got the valleys. You know, if it's your heritage, it's where you're from, but it's up the road, isn't it? Literally up the road.
It is, and there's a kind of romanticism about Cardiff, which I've always had as well as growing up as a kid.
Seen as the big city then?
Oh God,
Cardiffian. I don't know how to process that because I've always lived here, so.
Is it seen as the? It's definitely seen as the big city, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and when I was growing up, well, it was really funny because when I was growing up, certainly when I was a teenager and I was escaping to Cardiff.
Yeah.
You know, I was escaping to Cardiff.
Bright lights.
With the big lights, you know, the fast cars, the tall buildings, you know, all of those things. my mother used to say to me, I'd be coming down here illegally, I must say. Groups of us coming down on a minibus to see a gig, perhaps at the university, the Great Hall, you know, all the Top Rank, as I said. And she'd be, oh, you've got to be careful, you know, Cardiff, you know, all those city kids, they're really rough and whatever. And, you know, and we'd all arrive from places like Penrhyn and Abercomboy and places like that. And we found all the people in Cardiff were shit scared of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we were just like, these barbarians coming down from these mountains.
Anyone north of the Traveller's Rest, God almighty.
But I think, you know, we romanticise Cardiff. I mean, I got a poem here, and I'm going to read all of it. But this is typical of the kind of the miner's mentality.
Yeah.
Idris Davis, you know, back in the 1930s, writing in a day out, we went to Cardiff when the skies were blue and spent our shillings freely in Queen Street and the bright arcades and in the cockle market.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that romanticism about Cardiff, which which I think people from the valleys do have. And then there's that other side of it, which is, we don't really need them down in Cardiff, you know. The big city slickers, Pontypridd is just as good, you know. I'll go out in town. Where's town? Up there, you know. and I think there's, you know, there's a lot to be said for that as well. But I mean, I've had a great time, you know, living in Cardiff. And I've lived all over the UK. I travel all over for work as well. Cardiff is the city I would definitely come back to.
And how do you see the changes then? Do you see them over as a positive thing overall, or because it has, you know, all everywhere changes. I know that, but having been a lot of, lived myself a lot of places around the UK, it seems to have changed more rapidly. Maybe because it's a capital, it's changed more rapidly.
I think the big shift for me, I moved to Cardiff in the very early 90s, having been a youth and community worker in Surrey, you know, with all the kids pulled up at the youth centre in cars, much better than mine, I understand.
I was going to say, it's a different set of issues.
Yes, completely different, you know. You know, I moved to Llanhead and I said I was working in Splott. And at that time, you know, Cardiff Bay Development Corporation was very much still around. And I had the good fortune to come into contact with a lot of people at the time, like Lord Brooks, Jack Brooks.
Yeah.
Because I was based on St. Croix Street in Splott, Jack was obviously the agent of Jim Callaghan, and you know he was one of the architects of that change. You know, and you know, and I know people might have had different ideas about Jack, but all I can say is that I did manage to get Jack to find £83,000 to do the youth centre up, and he did that. You know, he was a real community spirited guy. You know, I had to take him down the pub and talk him about boxing for 2 hours. But, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I'm like, well, that's a massive figure in those days as well.
Massive figure. And on the proviso, he said, I'll, we can get the money for you. It was all done legally, obviously. Yeah. But he said, we'll get the money for you. On the proviso, you let Jim come and open it, Jim Callaghan. Oh. So you know, and it's just like, you know, what's not the link?
That's hardly a bind, is it?
So yeah, massive changes. Yeah. I think the big change, though, I think for me, was the kind of disappearance of a lot of stuff that places I used to misspend my youth in. You know, so anything from the top of Bute Street down, you know, pubs like the Custom House, you know, the real dens of iniquity, as were. Trust me, as a 15, 16-year-old from Penrhaeibr, those dens of iniquity were something special.
You must have had your eyes on storks going in those places.
Eyes on storks, you know. But again, you know.
Or trying to be cool.
Trying to be cool, yeah. You know. But again, you know, and in the early 80s as well, you know, I'd been in a band here in South Wales, and we gigged very widely, you know, before I went off to university. And there were places on Cardiff that just don't exist now. Just down the road from where we're sitting now in Roth, of Poets Corner pub, you know, became PC's Food and Drink Factory, I think, for a while. Yeah, my band played in there, you know, Pink Ippo, we played all over. And a lot of those venues have just disappeared. You know, the big Windsor down the docks was one of the big ones for us.
Is that just the price of progress then? Because other venues have shot up. So is that just how it goes, or do you think more of effort should have gone into preserving these places?
Well, I think, you know, if on one hand I'm talking about the need for regeneration up the valleys, and then, you know, I've got to be careful not to put myself in a box here and say regeneration has been bad for Cardiff, because it hasn't been bad for Cardiff.
Overall,
you know?
No.
I still call Cardiff Bay the Docks.
That ages
me, I think. Yeah. My wife, who's younger than me, calls it Cardiff Bay, you know, and she has a different relationship to me.
Yeah.
You know, I go down there and it's okay. Hmm. You know, I preferred it in the old days, but that's me. Yeah. You know,
tell you what, it takes your breath away when you see it in what I would call the wasteland years before they.
Oh, yeah.
It does take your breath away, because I just about remember that. And as a kid, sort of early, sort of mid-teens, me and my mates would walk around the docks, and we remember it was ruined. You know, there was nothing there. So you've got to say this is better, but then prior to that, when it was a full-on industry and all that, I can see why people would say, you know, what happened to all that industry and live, you know, that is just the churn of.
Well, that's
the
right.
Years,
I mean, and we're, you know, where Atlantic Wharf is, you know, around that general wharf area. As I said, I came back to Cardiff in the early 90s. I was working in Splott, and of course, County Hall was already built then. The Pagoda, as we used to call it back in those days. And it was the only thing there.
It was an oasis.
Yeah. It was just rubble on the way down to it. And the service roads were all in. When I had to go for meetings down there, I used to walk down from the youth centre in the day, and I'd walk through rubble.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like something like a science fiction film, and in the distance you had the pagoda sort of shining brightly.
Yeah.
There. But it wasn't much else down there, really.
And you had the Norwegian church in its original site, just as a sort of ruin. You could make out what it was, but that just shone out as well.
That's
and
right.
Again, it was just in a big sort of field, not even a field, just rubble.
But, and I think that, and I think some of the links back through the history of Cardiff, you do see those landmarks, and obviously, the Pierhead building and stuff. But then, we forget, we had the Maritime Museum down there, which is a brilliant resource.
It was the end of the bus line, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great.
It was that was a big old, well, I don't know if I'm remembering it wrongly, but as a kid, I thought that was massive. What a great place. Yeah.
I thought it was quite big as well, as an adult. But then again, there were other things down in Cardiff, as I said, landmarks, which do sort of stand out, particularly at top end of Boot Street. You got, the church and stuff at the top end But I mean, Boot Street was a very different proposition then.
Oh, yeah. Notorious, wasn't it, back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, people used to go on about Boot Street as being this terrible place to walk down, but I never had any problems walking down there. And I walked down here quite frequently, as I recall. But I mean, I think there's something else in the history of Cardiff, as I said, in terms of this idea that now Cardiff is suddenly this big international city. Believe it or not, I used to abscond, say, down from the valleys as a teenager, and I'd come down here on a Friday night and not go home till a Sunday morning. It's driving me up the wall the days before mobile phones, you can imagine.
Yeah. It is unimaginable now,
isn't it? It's unimaginable, it would be the case, we'd have tickets to go and see something on a Friday with the intention of coming back on a Friday night.
Yeah.
And we'd be at a top rank, and then, you'd meet people you'd get to know, and then you'd end up in a blues party down the docks, which happened to me frequently. Yeah. Made a lot of friends down there, black and white.
Yeah.
It was a very mixed environment on the old punk gigs, because we had usually had reggae DJs starting the thing off anyway, so it was an attraction.
And the ska revival must have been very multiracial, because that was
all
key
of that,
part of it, wasn't it?
All of that.
Yeah.
But what would tend to happen, you'd be a kid, you'd get excited, you'd be there all day Saturday, something else would happen, you'd spend Saturday night. Mm. But then 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning, you'd wash up at Asti's on the old bus station. Probably the worst cafe that ever existed in South Wales.
Asti's
deadly pasties.
Oh, God.
But some of those nights you'd spend, and it'd be Turkish cafes open.
Mm.
You'd be kids in there. Everybody else would be about 405. But they were there. Those overnight places did exist even back then.
Yeah.
So
it's funny, isn't it? I mean, people portray it as it wouldn't have been as open, because. The Queen Street and all that, and say Mary Street, now it's buzzing all night, but that it didn't used to be like that. And
that's
say,
right.
But if you knew where to look, it was there.
The pockets were definitely there, and I think a lot of those pockets existed, I guess, back in those days more in the suburbs. And I think, to link this to an earlier question you asked about what it takes to be a CEO, a chief executive, being inquisitive and not being afraid, as a teenager, I was very, very inquisitive.
Yeah.
There was something, I knew there were dangers, right? But you calculate risk all the time.
Yeah.
And those lessons of my teenage years have never left me.
Mm.
I'm still inquisitive. I still want to know things. I still have to calculate risks. So,
That's brilliant. I think that's a perfect place to stop as well.
I'd like to stop by...
You're going to have to get back to work.
I'd like to stop by actually putting another quote out there, actually.
Oh, go on.
Right. So there was a... There was a poet called Harry Webb. Harry was a big national poet in Wales, and he happened to be the librarian in the Cannon Valley. So I grew up with this guy. I was only allowed to call him Mr. Webb by my mother.
Right.
But he was, he was a very round poet. Harry spelt with an I, by the way, H-A-R-R-I, Webb.
Cool.
And he lived in council accommodation, so where our stock is now up in Cumbach.
Yeah.
And he stocked Mountain Ash Library full of brilliant works. Bohemian works. Mm. So, all the Kerouacs in this world, the Burroughs, all the good stuff. But also lots of Anglo-Welsh poets as well, like John Tripp, which is a subject for another day.
Yeah.
But there's last four lines from Harry Webb for this podcast.
Do it.
And it's four lines, and it's a poem called Answer from Limbo. And it goes, "Where will you spend eternity? The posters question us. The answer comes quite readily, waiting for a Cardiff bus." And that's exactly what I'm going to go and do shortly.
Tremendous. That's absolutely tremendous. Now, thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure.
We need to get you on again. So whenever down the line, if you want to come on again, that would be tremendous. But for now, that's absolutely superb. Ian Thomas, thank you very much.
Thanks, Al.
Huge thanks to Ian for a very entertaining chat. It's so good to hear someone who has so much passion for the job they do. I really enjoyed that, and hopefully Ian will come on again sometime in the future. Please rate and review the podcast. It really, really makes a difference and gets the word out there. And join me again soon when I return with David Clubb, Head of Renewable UK Cymru. But for now, thanks for listening.